we're at a unique moment in history where we all have an opportunity to rethink how we move forward. It's exactly in these moments of crisis that we all need to have courage to dream big about how things should work, not just about how things do work. How do we all keep up and learn what we need to know as technology and everything else keep changing around us? We're at a tipping point. The World Economic Forum says 50% of us are going to need to learn new skills by 2025. We know that to make this kind of change, we cannot do this alone. Leaders everywhere are realizing technology is here to help, but also you need to have a vision of how everybody wins and how everyone can take part.
Great companies are all about the people. Good people become great leaders, mentors for work and life.
Welcome to Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. I'm Andrew Tarvin, humor engineer.
And I'm Roman Segal, recovering marketer. Andrew and I both got our start at P&G, the Procter & Gamble company, where we both had the opportunity to work with some amazing people. And as you may know, many leaders across industries got their start at P&G. In this series, through conversations with fellow P&G alums, we hope to go deeper with the leaders you already know but want to know more about. How they got their start, how they make it work, and what keeps them going.
It's kind of like bringing a microphone to a cup of coffee, or in my case, hot chocolate.
On today's show, we're talking to P&G alumni leader Lisa Kefelber, Google's Chief Marketing Officer for the Americas. It was a great conversation about making an impact with the work that you do. Here's a quick bio. Lisa Kefelber is Google's Chief Marketing Officer for the Americas, leading marketing for flagship Google products like Search, Maps, Ads and Commerce, YouTube, Play, Chromebooks, and Android. In 2017, Lisa founded Grow with Google, Google's $1 billion commitment to ensure the opportunities created by technology are available to everyone, which has helped more than 6 million Americans grow their skills, careers, and businesses. Under Lisa's leadership, Grow with Google launched Google Career Certificates, which provide on-ramps to in-demand, high-paying jobs for people without college degrees. These certificates have provided significant upward mobility to tens of thousands and counting. Lisa also leads Google for Startups, which levels the playing field for entrepreneurs globally by supporting underrepresented founders. Prior to joining Google in 2010, Lisa spent 9 years in senior management roles at Intuit, as well as leading at startups and nonprofits alike. And of course, she got her start at P&G in brand management, where over 6 years, she led a $400 million portfolio of brands. Lisa serves on the Council for Foreign Relations. She's an inventor on 6 patents and holds a degree from the University of Michigan. She's a proud mom of 2 girls and lives in the Bay Area with her family and an avid hiker and passionate world traveler. Now, what I love about Lisa is how candid she was about her approach to work and how mission-driven she's made her work at Google. You know, sometimes people think of marketing as a siloed, businessy thing, but in Lisa's career, she's really honed in on insights to drive her work, not just in marketing campaigns, but in the creation of products that tap into very human needs. We face big challenges in our economy when it comes to equity and equality, and one of the key drivers of that is matching skills to people who might not have the means to change their career trajectory. Ultimately, Lisa's strategy at Google is a rising tide approach, not a zero-sum mentality that's going to make things better. And this is something that Lisa and her team are working on every day, even outside of the walls of Google. Lisa talks about how in moments of crisis, we need to focus on how things should work. How do we bring the whole ecosystem together? Because working together is how everybody wins. But let's dive right in. We hope you'll enjoy our conversation with Lisa Kefelber. Today, we're talking to Lisa Kefelber, Chief Marketing Officer for Google's Americas region. Lisa, welcome to the podcast. It's really great to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Lisa, a lot of people already know your professional story. As Google's Chief Marketing Officer for the Americas, you lead marketing for a lot of Google's flagship products like Search, Maps, Ads, Commerce, YouTube, Play, Chromebooks, and Android. And in 2017, you founded and now lead Grow with Google, Google's $1 billion commitment to ensure opportunities created by technology are available to everyone, which has helped more than 6 million Americans grow their skills, careers, and businesses, and is particularly relevant in the times we live in. You also lead Google for Startups, which levels the playing field for entrepreneurs globally by supporting underrepresented founders. And prior to joining Google in 2010, you spent 9 years in senior management roles at Intuit, as well as leading at startups and nonprofits alike. And of course, you got your start at P&G in brand management, where over 6 years, you led a $400 million portfolio of brands. You serve on the Council of Foreign Relations, you're an inventor on 6 patents, and you hold a degree from the University of Michigan. And there's a lot in there that I want to ask about, but I guess my first question, Lisa, is who were you before that, before your career journey started? Is there a story you can tell us from your youth?
Sure. Well, I still think of myself as a young Midwestern girl. I take to heart that saying about being Midwestern nice. It's how I think of myself. And I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is, as everyone knows, a great college town. And I was a townie. I grew up with two brothers. I'm the middle child and the only girl in my family. So I grew up playing a lot of sports with my brothers, mostly like football, literally in the street in front of our house. And those are truly some of my favorite moments. So I grew up playing football in the streets with my brothers. It was one of my absolute favorite things to do. And ironically, later when I moved to Cincinnati and worked for P&G, I started a co-ed touch football team in the Sport and Social Club in Cincinnati. We ended up going to the national championships and came in third in the country.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
You know, I never had a dream for what I wanted to be when I grew up, but I certainly had no vision of working in business, or technology wasn't really a thing when I was a kid, or at least not a part of my world. I actually used to think business was evil and I was going to go work in some nonprofit and save the world. But ironically, my path has kind of come full circle. And the fact that I learned a ton by working in lots of different businesses like P&G and for 20 years now here in Silicon Valley has actually helped me do more to change the world than I think any nonprofit I would have worked at could have.
Wow. Back then, when you were a kid and you didn't know what you wanted to be, what was the actual first way that you made money? What was your first job?
My first job was actually a retail job. I actually worked in the men's department of a department store. And come Christmas time, I would spend pretty much all night folding sweaters and refolding sweaters that were taken apart and tried on all day. I used to be very, very good at guessing men's shirt sizes.
Are there any meaningful lessons from that time growing up, folding sweaters, playing football in the streets of Ann Arbor?
Our parents told us from the time we were very young that they expected us to go to college. My dad was the first, and he and his brother were the first in his family to go to college. So they always expected us to go, and they thought education was super important. But they told us that we'd have to pay for our college ourselves. So my brothers and I, we all put ourselves through college. So I think I started working when I was 14 or 15, and I've pretty much been working ever since. And back then, it didn't seem so fun having to work to pay your way through school. But in the end, I think it actually taught me a lot of things about the value of hard work and also the value of an education.
So if we fast forward to today, how are you similar to that younger version of yourself, or how are you different?
I've always loved work. I actually liked work more than school my whole life. I did well in school, but I did it because I thought I had to. Work was always more rewarding to me, getting things done, like actually making a difference, being part of a team. That was always so much more fun to me than staring at a book or sitting in a classroom. I'm a doer more than an academic, and theory was never as interesting to me as actual problem solving. So I think the fact that I started working when I was young and I liked work and I've always liked work has been super helpful for me throughout my career.
Well, so you eventually do finish school and you get a job, and I'm guessing you moved to Cincinnati. So are there any defining early career moments that taught you important lessons early on?
Yeah, I have no idea why P&G hired me.
You and me both.
I think I was the least prepared person ever for the job when I got it. And thank God a handful of people at P&G believed in me along the way. I think one of the most important things that I learned at P&G, and something that has served me so well for my entire career ever since, is the ability to write. I know P&G catches a lot of flack for the two-page memo, but the two-page memo was a gift to me because I was terrible at it. I was truly terrible. And through a lot of red ink by several of my bosses, I became really good at it. And this ability to write a compelling argument and articulate a business recommendation and rationale on paper in a super concise and clear way, I think has been a lot of how I've been successful in my career. And it was painful. Of all the things that I didn't like in school, English was definitely top of the list. So for me, being at P&G and literally having bosses tear apart my documents over and over and over again until I figured it out was painful in the moment and truly invaluable in the end. And actually, even today, I tell people, there are very, very few weaknesses that you really need to focus on. Like, mostly what you should do is focus on your strengths. But I tell them that the one career-limiting weakness, certainly in the field of marketing, is if you can't write, you can't advance. I don't mean creative writing. I mean literally business writing.
Conveying ideas.
Yeah, and being compelling and concise. If you can't be compelling and concise in written form, it's just really hard to be a good leader. It's hard to get things done in big and complicated organizations. It's hard to communicate to broad groups of people that you don't see every day or who don't have context about what you're talking about. You have to be able to do it. And I think the greatest gift that P&G gave me was teaching me to write in a compelling and concise way. I wish they hadn't had to. I wish I'd learned it along the way, but I'm definitely grateful that they did.
Yeah, I've been in tech and startups for years, and I tell a lot of my design buddies and product buddies that good writing is good UX. To your point of, you're trying to communicate something to someone that isn't necessarily paying attention to what you are doing. So be that in an app, be that in an email you send to someone, be it in getting someone ready for a podcast even. But I still to this day care. I don't know if they had leadership on paper when you were there, but that's one of the few pieces of training and notebooks that I still keep from my time in Cincinnati.
Oh my God, I wish I had that notebook back then. I think I learned it all the hard way. My boss just tore up my stuff over and over again until I finally figured it out.
Yeah. Was there anything early on that didn't work out the way you thought it would?
I feel like I've been very, very lucky in my career. Whenever there's been something that didn't quite go the way we intended, there's always a bigger and more important lesson. One of the first things when I moved to Silicon Valley, actually, like 20 years ago, one of the first things I learned about was the value of company culture. We had a whole bunch of smart people working on a pretty interesting problem at the time, and we got pretty far along, but it became a not very fun place to work. And one of the reflections I have on that is actually that it's because none of us made a conscious effort to think about the kind of culture we were trying to create in this company, right? I was employee number 5. So if we had been thoughtful, I think from the beginning, and I think we became a couple hundred people in the end, we could have both had a successful organization, but also been a really fun and interesting and values-oriented place to work. We didn't commit the bandwidth to it. We didn't focus on it. And I think if you don't create culture, it creates itself. So one of my biggest lessons is really just about how much effort you have to put in as a leader of an organization or an early person if you're starting a company into creating the culture that you want, right? Because, and even at Google now, I think a lot about culture because within a company, you have all different cultures on different teams, right? Because a company can create conditions for culture, but people create culture. And as leaders, we all have to decide what's the culture we want on our team. What are going to be the norms of behavior? What do we believe in? How do we treat each other? And I think that's been one of the most interesting lessons I learned from a time where it didn't really go so well earlier in my career.
You worked at arguably 3 pretty massive companies in your career across Procter, Intuit, and Google. What would you say, or how would you compare and contrast the culture of those 3 companies?
That's super interesting, actually. So Intuit, as you probably know, was founded by a former Procter and Gamble employee. So it was founded by Scott Cook, who's brilliant and still a dear friend and mentor of mine. So a lot of the things I think that made Procter a good place, he brought with him when he created Intuit. And so the general manager structure at Intuit, I think, built off the back of Procter & Gamble's structure, which is very unusual in tech. In Silicon Valley, there's almost never kind of a general management structure. But Scott believed that one person had to own kind of the end-to-end customer experience, that what mattered at the end of the day to him were things like net promoter scores and the user experience. And he didn't think he could accomplish that, I think, without having a general manager structure. And so he built one. Scott's one of my favorite people of all time and someone I've learned a ton from, not just structurally, but in terms of his real attention to gaining insights from users. He has an absolute obsession with learning from everyone around him and certainly learning from your customers. And so I think the thing that Intuit is world-class at is really understanding your customers by, he calls it follow me homes. literally following your customer home and sitting with them in their home while they do the task. And I think that's something he learned at P&G, but that we didn't do nearly enough at P&G. I think Scott made it an art and science. And Intuit, the way you worked at Intuit was always based on user insights. And the way you added value was being the person who knew the customer the best and could speak the most to what they had learned about the customer, what the customer needed. User insights were king at Intuit. And I think it started from what Scott had learned at P&G, but he took it to an entirely new level.
Yeah, one thing I've always found the most eye-opening isn't just understanding like the basic demographics and even product-driven insights, but understanding the broader consumer context, all the other things probably going on in this person's life that inform their opinions and their usage patterns. Intuit and Google are both kind of big companies in tech, but Google's decidedly different in its approach to consumers. So how does that translate to the culture? What does the idea of being googly mean?
Being googly is about so much more than just focus on the user. I mean, when Larry and Sergey founded the company, it was definitely user-first mentality. They truly believed that unless they built something that was so powerful and useful for the users, people wouldn't use it. And as a matter of fact, initially, they didn't believe in marketing. And I think being googly became a phrase that's about how you show up at work every day, which is with a sense of curiosity and ambition to use technology for the good of the user, right? We know that billions and billions of times a day, people come to Google to get an answer or get something done, whether it's get directions from Google Maps or find an answer that's important to them in their lives. And so being googly is about the belief that the user matters first and foremost, and that it's our job to use the technology to solve for the user. But it's also about being curious and not taking yourself too seriously. We take the user very seriously and the opportunity very seriously, right? I think Google is one of the places who has had some of the most impact in the world. And it's because we take the user and the opportunity seriously, but
Takes
ourselves a little less seriously, I would say.
Yeah. And it shows up in the end user experience. A lot of folks listening to this might not be in tech, but tech is kind of becoming the undercurrent of the entire world. Whereas before, when we were starting our careers, it was kind of a niche area, a niche sector. And a lot of us face career forks of the road. And one of those I think that you made was to leave packaged goods in general management and go into tech. What was that decision like? How did you make that leap?
That's funny. When I was at P&G, I was a brand manager on one of the big laundry brands at the time. And laundry is about as old school at P&G as you can get. But it's an awesome training ground. And at the time, there was a guy named Jamie Agasti, who's actually someone you should definitely have on your podcast. And they had tapped Jamie to go create a new products division. And at the time, there hadn't been a new category of products, I think, created by P&G since the 60s, when they created bounce dryer sheets or something. And I think the company really got the casting right when they picked Jamie. And they tapped Jamie and said, we need new categories, not just new brands and products and categories that we already work in. And Jamie created this new products team, which ended up delivering brands that we all know today as everyday brands, Swiffer, Febreze, those all came out of Jamie's team. And when Jamie was assembling the first team, he picked a whole bunch of us, including me, to go and work on new products. And I think at the time, everyone thought, well, that's the death knell of your career. At the time, as I said, P&G hadn't created a lot of new categories in decades. And so this idea that you would go join this team of people who are going to create not just new products in existing categories, but new categories, right, was a crazy idea. And I think I learned a ton from Jamie. He's still one of my favorite managers of all time. And one of the things that he believed in was that you had to show the team that the challenge was big, but that they were capable of it. And I think we even had an offsite called Mission Impossible or something.
You were all suspended from the ceiling on jumping cables?
No, but we were all at night around a fire pit, and we used this fire pit metaphor where we all came together as a team to solve this hard thing for years after, we had this kind of fire pit moment. But Jamie taught me a bunch of things about myself that I really never knew. And one of the things he taught me is that I make connections that other people don't necessarily see. I see patterns other people don't necessarily see. And I think when you're good at something, you never appreciate it about yourself because it comes easy to you and you don't give it a thought and you just assume everyone can do what you do. But that was a really important moment in my career, was just understanding that seeing patterns and building things from scratch was something that I actually really enjoyed. And it gave me energy and it tapped into strengths that I had. And that was a big part of the reason I ended up moving to Silicon Valley. So there ended up being a giant exodus of traditional consumer packaged goods people to Silicon Valley eventually. But I came years before
that.
And so I came to Silicon Valley because I wanted to build things from scratch in the way that Jamie had kind of inspired me to do and to believe in myself and my ability to do way back at P&G. And so I decided there's no better place to do that than try Silicon Valley. So I literally packed a bag and moved out here without a job.
Wow.
I slept on friends' couch for like 3 months, just trying to figure out how to get into a very early stage startup, because that's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to go to, even back then, there were a few kind of big-ish companies. Yahoo was a really big deal in the late 90s. And I decided I just want to go to something really early. And I ended up being, you know, employee number 5 at a Kleiner Perkins backed startup. And it was exactly what I thought being in Silicon Valley needed to be about, which was go in early, build from scratch, literally a handful of people in one room together, creating something from nothing. And I had the courage to do that because I had learned from Jamie and Jamie believed in me.
It's really interesting. I had the experience, privilege, and the opportunity of going to an early stage company, less than 10 people. And when it's that small venture-backed company, you have some resources, right? But you don't have a lot to rely on. You don't have a lot of the baggage and the assumptions of other things that sometimes big companies have. And that's what's so interesting about tech, because they're product first and they're starting with new things. But as a marketing person at companies like Intuit eventually, and then Google, where you yourself have said marketing wasn't a priority in the early years of these companies. How do you navigate as a business person, as a marketing person at a company in a culture that isn't necessarily marketing led, like say traditional CPG might be?
I mean, at the end of the day, the best tech companies are user driven, right? They're all about deep consumer insights and user needs. And the good news is most marketing people are really good at that. If they care about it, if they get energy from it, because the best marketing comes from those same insights. But tech companies use it also to build the products. And actually, when I moved to Silicon Valley, I became a product person. I became a product marketing person. And I really enjoyed that. I think being close to the product and being at Intuit and owning the end-to-end customer experience, those were my favorite parts. Maybe I'm just not a traditional marketer in the sense of...
You don't want to make 30-second ads necessarily.
I don't. It's never been a goal of mine to make the best commercial ever. But if I can use a consumer insight to build a better product, I mean, there's a real high that comes from that.
So I want to shift gears a little bit. A lot of people in our audience are rising diverse professionals in a world that still has a lot of adversity. And you've had a very successful professional career, but you've also had the lived experience of being a woman in the workforce and in the world. Can you share any personal professional experiences where you've had to kind of face, experience, or overcome adversity and how that kind of shaped you?
I'd say one of the things that I learned pretty early on, especially because oftentimes I was one of very few women in the room, is you have to figure out, now that you're at the table, how are you going to add value at the table? What's the unique thing that you're going to bring? And for me, that has often been bringing the voice of the customer, or the voice of the user to the table. It's where I get my passion and energy personally. And so I'm often the person who knows the best about a particular user experience. And so I had that to offer. But I also think sometimes when you're not sure what you're offering, sometimes even asking a question that takes the group to another place is actually a really useful thing. So if you're not sure you know the answer, but you do have a question, it's quite likely that lots of other people in the room either haven't thought of that question and should, or are asking the same question in their own heads. And just the ability to put out a question that's significant in the moment can also add a ton of value. So I think the key is being at the table is all about figuring out how do you add value in the room? What are you uniquely bringing? Whether it's a piece of knowledge or insight or an ability to ask a question that takes the group kind of to the next level of thinking.
Yeah. And it's kind of being comfortable enough to bring your whole self, admitting what you don't know, because chances are other people don't know it as well. And I think sometimes you have that inertia of everyone just kind of going along with it, even though no one wants to call out the elephant in the room sometimes, proverbially. Yeah. Was there ever a moment when you took your foot off the gas pedal?
You know, I took 6 months off between jobs at one point. And quite honestly, I wish I'd used them differently. I think I spent way too much time thinking about what I wanted to do next and not enough time really living in the moment. So I would definitely advise anyone who is taking time off, be thoughtful about being in the moment on really taking the time off. And whether it's finding something you want to do or a place you want to go to or people you want to spend time with, as we all know, time flies. And I think being focused on really, really taking it off and not just thinking about the next part of your journey is probably what I would do differently.
So the idea of work-life balance is a bit of a misnomer. It means something different to everyone, be it work-life insanity in the current moment that we're living in, finding harmony. How do you kind of thread the needle of your personal and professional life throughout a career like the one that you've had?
I think part of that is just really liking your job.
That's
Get into a job you really enjoy so that when you're thinking about it, you're thinking about problems that interest you or you're thinking about accomplishing something you really care about. I mean, I think part of it is just really liking what you do and making sure that it's making your life better. And then I think the other thing is just getting really good at making a few boundaries and getting good at context switching, which is something you do at work all day anyway. If you have a big job, you're constantly context switching. But just being able to switch between work mode and life mode a little bit, I think is pretty helpful.
Yeah, I think as long as you're enjoying what you're doing, either at home or at work, it's just about energy management then at that point. It's not more complicated. So I'll bite. You sound like you really like what you do. And I recently only started to understand kind of what you're doing beyond just marketing stuff at Google, right? This Grow with Google is something that's pretty interesting and exciting that I don't think a lot of people know about. Can you talk about why that's exciting or why that's been such a passion point for you? Because you literally founded this program.
Yeah, I mean, I feel so lucky to have been given this opportunity. So in 2017, some of the senior folks at Google took a step back and thought a little bit about where were the places in addition to our products that we wanted to be able to make a disproportionate impact on the world. And we decided on economic opportunity. How could we use the opportunity, make sure that the opportunities created by technology would truly be available to everyone in a way that furthered their economic opportunity and helped them achieve their economic potential? And so I got the lucky task of, in addition to my day job, thinking about what could Google do that would make a big impact on the world. And I put together a proposal. And next thing you know, we were launching Grow with Google. And our goal really was all about economic opportunity, which meant two things. How do we help small businesses succeed using technology? How do we really unlock the power of technology for small businesses, which in the current pandemic, I think has been invaluable. I think digital has been a safety net for businesses all over the world. And then how do we help people get the skills they need to have really successful careers and lives? And our focus from the get-go was the 2/3 of Americans who do not get 4-year college degrees. And actually, that number is not that different in other even developed countries in the world. I think in the UK, about 50% of people do not have a college degree. And that means there's 80 million American workers who don't have a college degree and feel like, therefore, a great job is likely out of reach for them. And we fundamentally decided we wanted to tear down those barriers And we wanted to not only give people the skills they needed to get into in-demand, high-growth, high-paying jobs, but we also wanted to change the way employers thought about different routes where people could get skills, where the degree wasn't the answer, right? I think almost all employers know that degrees are a terrible proxy for most jobs.
But yet a lot of job applications say the requirement is must have a four-year degree or an equivalent, but that equivalent is never really defined as what is acceptable or not, right?
Yeah, actually, that's a huge part of the problem. And we talked about getting the voice of the user. We went and talked to a bunch of very senior talent acquisition people, right? So the people in companies that do all the recruiting. And they would tell you, oh, we don't require college degrees for most of our jobs. And if you look at our job descriptions, it says exactly what you just said, Roman. It says college degree or equivalent. The problem is that no one had really defined equivalent. How did you figure out someone had the skills for the job? So we went about trying to solve this problem of getting people into these in-demand, high-growth, high-paying jobs. And we did it by creating a career certificate program where we actually taught people everything they need to know to do these jobs. And we took Google employees with decades of years of experience in these fields. And then those people worked from the job back. They did job task analysis and skills assessments and figured out what would you need to be able to teach someone to do to be successful.
And you weren't just doing this for jobs at Google. Maybe you were using that as kind of your basic user understanding, but these are certifications that while Google accepts them, it's valid everywhere else, right?
Yeah, one of the most important things we did actually was bring other employers in from the get-go. So when we are building the curriculum for our career certificates, we have employers who hire a lot of people in those fields look at the curriculum and actually even contribute to it. So we now have 4 career certificate fields. We have IT support, data analytics, user experience design, and project management. And employers have vetted every single one of them. As a matter of fact, Deloitte contributed even some of the exercises in our data analytics certificate. And in the IT support certificate, it's everything that we teach our own entry-level employees at Google. So employers were key from the beginning. We now have 130 employers in our employer consortium. These are all people who are eager to hire the certificate graduates in these fields because they know they have the skills they need to be job ready for these jobs. And there really is a skills gap. There's 1.3 million open jobs in these 4 fields in the US alone right now. There just aren't people trained for them. And so employers are hungry for the right talent and actually are really excited about the fact that this brings them diverse, non-traditional talent into these jobs.
Well, the stats from the certification that I read online or for people who have completed the program don't look like the stereotypical Harvard grad, Silicon Valley bro kind of role. There's more veterans, there's more BIPOC, et cetera, who are completing these certifications and becoming eligible for these roles.
Yeah, that's my favorite thing about these career certificates is that they are truly making a more equitable and inclusive economy for everyone. Because we are successfully graduating people who are not traditional in these fields. 53% of our graduates exactly come from the groups you just talked about. They're BIPOC veteran or female. Almost 46% of our graduates start these programs from the lowest income tertile in our country, and they are graduating into career fields, which on average have an entry-level income of $69,000 a year. Right. And that's just the entry level income. So you obviously move up.
But that's a solid footing into the middle class of this country.
Oh, yeah. We pick these job fields because they're not only in demand today, but we know they are going to grow.
Yeah. As tech is eating the world, these are kind of core fundamental things to be done.
Yeah. You're going to have a job in these fields. And we pick the fields also knowing that these are jobs you can do from anywhere in this country. You don't have to move to Silicon Valley to get a job in any of the fields that I just mentioned, right? Data analysts are needed everywhere in all kinds of industries. They're needed in retail and healthcare. IT support is needed by every kind of organization, right? Not just businesses large and small, but nonprofits and governments and school systems. Everyone needs an IT person. So these fields are not going anywhere. And I think we are successfully bringing people from non-traditional backgrounds into these high growth, high paying fields. We graduated 50,000 people already just in our first career area, which was IT support, in 2 years. So tons of opportunity for folks to change careers and have a really different life for their families.
Well, another precedent that, and this is the one thing I was aware about this last year, mid-2020, Google announced, and this is kind of putting your money where your mouth is and leading with it, is you would accept applicants for jobs at your company who have achieved these certifications. So it's not some, oh, here's some certification thing on the side. A top employee in this country said, we're going to start defining what the equivalent is to the degree, and we're going to start accepting hires. And that was a pretty big move. It made some pretty big headlines. Have other people followed suit?
Oh, yeah. There's, as I said, 130 employers in our hiring consortium already. They're super eager to hire these folks. We even have some employers, Infosys and Better.com, that are making huge hiring commitments to hire hundreds or even thousands of these graduates. And we're also super excited that we have just announced a partnership with Guild Education, who helps reskill employees at companies like Walmart and Chipotle, Lowe's, Disney, Discover. And I think those companies do amazing work giving their employees access to benefits that help them reskill. And the Google Career Certificates are now available through Guild and through that program.
And now a word from our sponsor. Today, we're talking to P&G alumni entrepreneur and my former boss and longtime mentor, Bob Gilbreth, who's now the co-founder and CEO of Hardy. Hardy is a recommendation network that just launched, and it's become a weekly habit of mine as I figure out how to find great people to hire and partner with. So Bob, I find Hardy great, but I guess what folks want to know is what exactly is a recommendation network and why do they matter more than, I don't know, just using LinkedIn or emails the old-fashioned way?
Great question, Raman. Well, I'd say anybody who is leading a growing business continually needs to find new employees, clients, suppliers, and partners. And when those needs arise, what do? We go to our networks of the people that we know and trust, and we ask that question, do you know a great blank? That's what we do. We're going to keep doing it, but it takes a lot of time and effort to ask one person at a time. You've got to decide what's the best way to reach them. Is it phone? Is it email? Is it text? And then wait for them to respond when they have time. Meanwhile, you mentioned LinkedIn. Yep, we're on LinkedIn. Everyone's on LinkedIn. That's the problem. It's not true relationships. It's these connections that are unknown. Many people don't even know how they met or when or where. And so that asking for those connections mostly fails on LinkedIn. We've been living this pain as we've grown our businesses, and we felt like the time was due for a new way. So that's why we built a recommendation network. And simply put, it's that short list of people that you truly know and trust.
That's so true. I feel like I've just collected this list of folks on LinkedIn over the years, and not a week goes by where someone messages me and asks, do you know so-and-so? And I'm like, I don't know. And you're really solving this pain point. I love the idea of the shortlist. So I know a handful of us have been on the beta, but I'm guessing the platform starts to get even more interesting when other people start to join.
You got it. And it all starts with coming in, starting to build your list, and then others do the same. And then we've got a list of folks that we do know and trust, and we can count on each other. It's the reputations that we built up and folks that we are very happy to connect with each other on those opportunities. So you come into the platform, you build your list, you find other people through our connections, recommend the people you love working with, share your trusted networks. And at the same time, we're also giving you some insights about your network, how you can improve the diversity of the folks that you work with and breadth. And then in addition to that, we're starting to work with company recruiters who are using Hardy as a new way to do referral hiring, which is much quicker, easier, and brings a bigger pool of people in versus the old way of just asking one at a time, hey, do you know anyone?
Wow, I really love this. And it's cool how you're looking at it from all angles of some days I might be looking for a gig, some days I might be looking to hire someone. So what's been the response so far?
It's been really great so far. We're just a couple of months in and we're focused on Cincinnati. But in terms of some of the numbers, we've had hundreds of thousands of connections imported into Hardy, and tens of thousands of recommendations being made. But the proof is in the fact that we're now regularly seeing people find opportunities and get hired because of the reputations and recommendations that they've grown on Hardy. And that's what we're about at the end of the day, helping great people find each other and work together and do magic.
I love how you guys are just separating the signal from the noise and just networking and recommendations. So how can folks learn more?
It's really easy. Just go over to signup.behardy.co. You can create your free profile there and start discovering and sharing opportunities and awesome people to work with.
Awesome. Well, Bob, thanks so much and best of luck.
Thanks very much.
And now back to our show. So I think it goes without saying that we have been living through some particularly crazy and challenging times. And the work you guys have been doing was kind of ahead of the curve on addressing some of these issues. But as kind of a purpose-driven leader and someone who is kind of leading industries and large organizations to kind of make positive change that is lasting, what kind of advice would you give to our leaders, be it in government, at the local, at the state, at the federal level, business leaders? How should leaders be thinking about the times that we're living in, and what sort of choices should they be making?
I think we're at a unique moment in history where we all have an opportunity to dream big and rethink. There's lots of ways society has worked in the past that absolutely do not need to define how we move forward. And I think when I wake up every morning excited about things like the Google Career Certificate, it's because, in fact, it is working toward and accomplishing a more inclusive and equitable world for all of us. And I think it's exactly in these moments of crisis that we all need to have courage to dream big about how things should work, not just about how things do work. And that's what my team and I get up every day thinking about, is how do we bring the whole ecosystem together? We know that to make this kind of change, we cannot do this alone. We need employers, but we also have nonprofits that work with us. We have community colleges that work with us. We're really bringing together the whole ecosystem, workforce development boards who help those who are currently unemployed to solve this problem. And together is the way we'll do it. And I think in order to get these kinds of massive opportunities to take shape, you need to have a vision of how the ecosystem is going to contribute, and how everybody wins, and how everyone can take part. And we built these Google Career Certificates in that way. We now even have four-year colleges that are giving credit for the certificates because they recognize that it's going to make their students more employable, that it's giving people real skills. And so places like Purdue University and Northeastern University give 12 college credits for the Google Career Certificate, right? And you know, a few years ago, you'd have never imagined something like that. But I think what's happening is leaders everywhere are realizing that they have a role to play and that technology is here to help, but also that we're at a tipping point at the moment where the World Economic Forum says 50% of us are going to need to learn new skills by 2025, 50%. And I think that's true of all of us, whether we're new to the workforce or we've been around for a while. And I think universities are realizing this opportunity, workforce development boards, nonprofits who are in the job training fields. Everybody wants to figure out, how do we all keep up? And how do we all learn to learn what we need to know to be successful as technology and everything else keep changing around us? So these are challenging times, but they're also really exciting times, because I think it's in moments like this we can make real change.
What I like about the approach you guys are taking is it's about systems change at kind of every level. It's not just about what's good for any one stakeholder. So what concerns or excites you for the future?
I think the things that excite me the most, I'm spending a little time in the user forums for our career certificates, is how eager people are to learn new things and how much people are believing in themselves and leaning into a different future than what they've had and supporting each other. You know, what inspires me the most is watching these people who are just diving in and taking control of their own careers. We have so many people. I love reading the user forums for our career certificates. I love hearing people's stories about the change they're trying to drive in their own life and their own motivation to go and learn something completely different than what they were doing. One of my favorite stories is a guy named Ray Giusto, who was a fireplace installer, who lost his job and his home in COVID. And he and his four kids had to move in with his grandparents. And then he did the Google IT support certificate, and now he has a tech job. and his family's moved into a new home. And it's people like Ray who believe in themselves and turn around their lives by just diving in and knowing they can learn what they need to learn to completely change the kind of career and future for their family.
That's great. So, Lisa, if you had an email or I guess Twitter time machine, what advice would you give your younger self?
I have this story of one of my favorite movies of all time. It's a movie called Miracle. I don't know if you know it. It's about the U.S. hockey team in the 1980 Olympics.
Oh, yeah.
And I just think it's such a great example of what I would tell anyone as they're starting their career, which is the U.S. hockey team in the 80s was a complete underdog. They were competing against the Soviets, who I think had won, like, I don't know, essentially every gold medal since 1964. The U.S. hockey team was a bunch of kind of amateur young kids. I think it might even have been the youngest team in history. And clearly underdog against all odds. And in the end, of course, it wouldn't be a movie unless they'd won. I'm not telling you. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
But I think what I love about that movie is I think it kind of teaches you three things, which is dream big, work hard, and play team. And so when I talk to folks about my career advice, it's kind of what I learned from Miracle the movie, right? Which is dream big, work hard, and always play team.
What's something your kids would say that they've learned from you?
So my kids are tired of hearing me say this, I think, but I'm a huge believer in Carol Dweck's growth mindset.
Fixed versus growth mindset, yeah.
Yeah, and that it's all about the journey and about not having to know the answer, but about believing that, you know, experience builds muscle and that experience can come in all kinds of ways where you don't need to know, you don't need to be the smartest person. What you need to know is that learning is the journey. And so my kids are a little tired, I think, of me talking about growth mindset, but I do believe Carol Dweck has changed my life. It's actually something I use a lot in the workplace. I learned about Carol Dweck from like a parenting seminar, but I took it to work with me because I think a lot of people got to places like Google because they were smart. And they think that the way they add value is being smart. But I really believe that what we needed to be was not smart, but we needed to be great learners. That's how we were going to add the most value. So
curiosity.
I really studied up a little bit about what Professor Dweck teaches, and I actually went and talked to her about it. And one of the things that I felt like was the most important in all the things she taught me was this idea of struggles, and that you kind of have to have struggles along the way and learn from them. And that one of the ways you avoid having a genius-oriented culture in your organization is by talking about struggles, because she said you have to kind of take the toxicity out of the word. And the way you do that is by talking about it. So in my team, all hands, you always have to present not just what you did and what you accomplished, but you have to present your struggles, and you have to use the word struggles. And that way we can all not only learn from your struggles and how you solved the problem, but we can create a culture in which it's okay to talk about struggles.
That's great. Since we've got to wrap up soon, I want to ask a few more fun questions. And you've kind of already answered the movie one, but what's a fact about you that surprises people?
There's one fun fact about me. I love the outdoors. I'm a total nature freak. And so a handful of years ago, I literally hiked from Yosemite to Lake Tahoe. So I think that's about 156 miles over 9 days. So getting out of nature, that's my passion.
What's your go-to movie escape? Are you more of a movie, book, or TV person?
I kind of like them all. I fell in love with Ted Lasso over the over the pandemic. As you can tell, I love a great underdog story and a great underdog sports story. That's like the perfect combination. But I also love a good book.
What's a book that you'd give to a friend?
Well, my favorite book is Katharine Graham's memoir. I don't know if you've read it, but super inspiring. Here's a person in our history who really, truly took over a lot of challenges. I don't know if you know her story, but she took over the Washington Post at a time where women were not expected to even be in the workforce, certainly not lead a major organization. And she's the one who made the decision around publishing the Watergate papers.
Fantastic film about her.
Yeah. The film doesn't even do justice.
Oh, really? Okay.
The book is phenomenal. And just the courage that it took to make some of those decisions, and also just her growing into leading this incredible organization and it's just a powerful story. And so the book I often give people is her memoir.
Who's someone out there that you would still want to get a cup of coffee with?
The person I'd like to have coffee with is Saul Kahn. And I think he's fundamentally made sure that people can learn anything they need to know from anywhere. And I think really, really leveling the playing field and education. I spent a lot of my work time in Latin America, and there's just so much opportunity. If kids can really access what they need to learn on their own online, it really helps given the educational systems in a lot of those places.
What's one final piece of advice or even a challenge that you would give to the next generation?
I think sometimes you have to do the things that you are most afraid of. I think when I look back at the decisions I've made in my life, anytime I've made a decision out of fear, it's been the wrong choice. And anytime I've kind of faced those fears and made a decision with courage, it's gotten me to a better place.
That's awesome. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for sharing your take and your perspective and honestly doing some really good work out there that's honestly going to help not just our country, but our society kind of get better and become more equitable. I really appreciate you making the time for us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's our show. Like what you heard? Please subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting platform. For show notes about this episode, links to things mentioned, or requests for sponsorship, visit pgalums.com/podcast. Follow us on Twitter at pgalumpod. We'd love to hear from you.
Learnings from Leaders is a production of the PNG Alumni Network, a global nonprofit founded by former PNGers committed to community, enrichment, and philanthropy. With more than 45,000 registered members worldwide, the network connects alums through global conferences, local chapters, industry events, and online content. Our nonprofit foundation supports economic empowerment communities around the world. To find out more, visit pgalums.com.
Now here's a preview of next week's episode.
If you're going to lead other people effectively, you have to learn how to lead yourself effectively. That's the heart of everything. And how do you lead yourself? Well, you're writing a story in your head of the things that you see around you. If you're always the hero of your own stories, which often we are, perhaps there's a blind spot you haven't recognized, right? Because we're not always the heroes. Everybody has a story in their head about something that they see about the business or about an action. Just be open to searching out those blind spots that may limit your ability to effectively lead a business or team. Search them out and be willing to learn about them, because the key to growth is being able to say, my natural instinct might be to do this in a situation, but I'm going to tamp that down and try to flex in a little bit different area.
That's it for this week. I've been Roman Segal.
And I'm still Andrew Tarvin. Thanks for joining Learnings from Leaders, the PNG Alumni Podcast. We'll see you next time.